Well, any, you could count on him if he wanted to get something done. He would do it really well and in incredibly grand style. But the Texans were being driven around town in these horse-drawn carriages, you know, giving tours of the campus and all that stuff. Then they come back to Whitehead's house, which looks a lot different now than it did back then, is at the corner of Sellers and
Main Street.
Yeah, it's certainly kind of Baroque, Rococo now. But he had this huge party going on for these Texans, and he had staff in the kitchen. And Professor Stevenson, as a matter of fact, was in the kitchen. He and Whitehead were big buds. In fact, that was the first time I met Stevenson, was at that party. But Southern Comfort served as the waiters, and we would walk around with trays of champagne and canapes and stuff like that serving. And then periodically, we'd put our trays down, and we'd form up beside the piano, and we'd sing a few songs, and you know, everybody'd laugh and sing and clap, and then we'd go back to work, and we'd be waiters again for a while. But
How charming!
It was
fun.
It was fun. It apparently worked.
Whitehead, the checks must have been flowing.
Well, Whitehead seemed pretty happy, and we did that. Mrs. Gottwald and her family. He was schmoozing her in the Reef Center. Actually, had a dinner for her. In the Reef Center, we were making fairly inappropriate jokes about we had to go over to the Reef Center and sing for Mrs. Gottrocks because Whitehead wanted to be nice to her. So we went over and we sang, and it sort of culminated with this, she's seated in a chair and we're kind of surrounding her in a semicircle. I've seen a photograph at school of that somewhere. I don't remember when. Fairly recently. Y'all have talked to Spice, but anyway, we sang, "Let Me Call You Sweetheart," and this is Gottwald. And apparently that was successful, too.
So you were also in Southern Comfort.
Yeah, I sure was.
I love Southern Comfort. I just think they are great. Tell me about that.
That was great. That was the group that really got to travel and go to alumni functions. And we pretty much did it ourselves. I mean, Spice was sort of the benevolent overseer. He sat in on some rehearsals and I think just made sure things didn't get too inappropriate. But we basically did what we wanted.
So it's student directed, pretty
much.
Oh,
yeah, it was.
That's what it seems to be.
Yeah, Todd Jones was sort of the brains behind the organization. He was a year behind me, but just oozing with show theatrical talent, and he did a lot of the. He selected a lot of the repertoire. We did a lot of the choreography. None of us, Todd said it once, and it's true. He said, I don't have a formal dancing background, and I'm happy to say that it shows in our performances. That's really true. We did Officer Krupke from West Side Story, and we just used our bodies for choreography. He used, made desks and psychiatrist couches and lamps and the great thing for Comfort was going to the Greenbrier every Christmas. We'd go, and they still do it too. I think we really tested them a few times we were there. But what a gig! I mean, in exchange for singing one number at T at the end of T, and for singing for an hour and a half in the old White Club. We got to stay, and we got breakfast and dinner. You know, just the Modified American Plan was ours, just for singing and bringing people in. And it was, what a gig. I mean, it still cost a fortune just in terms of bar bills, but it was a lot of fun. But we pushed them we were fairly loud. There were complaints time to time regarding the parties that were going on in our rooms. We ran out of ice once, so we stole the G ice sculpture that was out in front of the hotel and put it in the put it in the bathtub and chipped off pieces of that for our drinks. We were ice skating with pretty drunk, scaring the kids. But a lot of people came back just because we were there. We were one summer we went out to Indiana. Chris Schramm lived out there. I drove out with Ann Cowling. It was Dr. Cowling's daughter who was dating Chris at the time. We drove out. Todd came down. And we all went to Kings Island for a day. And we got, well, there's this sort of Hofbräu house and a show going on. And we had been drinking some beer and we started heckling. And by the time we left that day, we're on the little shuttle bus out to the parking lot. We were in rare form. And Smurfs were really big back then at that time. And Todd told one kid on the bus that Papa Smurf blew up. You know, the kid was like, I thought it was like, Papa Smurf blew up. And the kid's father looked at Todd and grinned and said, "You guys going to be back at the Greenbrier this Christmas?" And this guy knew who we were. It was scary. It's like, if you don't tell him about this episode, maybe. Sorry. But we had great times. Great times in Southern Comfort.
Mm-hmm. So, could you be in Southern Comfort just because you wanted to be, or did
you had to audition. Yeah.
So, obviously, not all members of the Glee Club are in Southern Comfort.
No, when I was there, and I don't know how my impression is, things may have changed some, but there were three and one alternate on a part, so a total of 16 guys. So it was a fairly small.
And do you have to, as part of your rehearsals, do you have to sit and watch Fred Astaire movies to get that casual elegance, or how does that happen?
That's a little too structured. No, that just sort of, it was a Zen kind of thing, and it just sort of happened.
Those guys just cracked me up. The Christmas concert just. I just sit there and wait. Come on. Wait for them to come out.
Yeah. They sang at Todd's service, which I thought was really nice. They sang, they did Java Jive, which was an old standard that we had done, and they sang Mountain Dew, which we did for the first time, I guess, when we were there. So it was nice. It was, I think, really appropriate to have them perform at Todd's service.
Now, how far back does Southern Comfort go? Was it in existence when you arrived?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I'm looking at yearbooks, there was something called the
Sazeracs.
Sazeracs?
Mm-hmm. Mish was in the Sazeracs, and Mish graduated in 76. So Southern Comfort, like Athena, I think, just sprang full-grown from somebody's forehead somewhere in between. It was already in existence, and my impression is had been in existence for more than just a year when I got there. So,
because yearbooks are not real helpful after a point. You know, they're wonderful picture books, but they don't have a lot of information in them after a while.
Yeah, I know. You can't trace much of a history from the Calyx, I don't think.
Well, up to a point you can. Up to a point they're very helpful. The older guys, I just run to the Calyx. But you guys, other than getting a feel for the times, it's kind of worthless. But I'm sure it's fun still.
Mm.
So, how about fancy dress?
How
about fancy dress?
Well, you had to go. I mean, you had to go. Although the best time I ever had at fancy dress was when my girlfriend and I had broken up just before it, and my friend Eric Heinsohn and his date sort of fell through, so Eric and I spent that fancy dress in my apartment. He was playing the guitar, and we're just kind of sitting around doing nothing. I know that's bad, but Fancy Dress was fun. Usually Lester Lannan and his orchestra was there. You didn't want your date to wear anything long, though, because you'd be walking around in beer usually about that deep once the evening wore on. But it was fun. Some of the dinners, we had a dinner. A bunch of us got together and cooked a really good meal. One year, I guess that was 83, before FD. Big parties the whole weekend long. It was a huge deal for some people and not as much of a deal for others. I probably fell in the latter category, I guess. I don't know that my time there was really the glory years of Fancy Dress. My impression is those were probably earlier.
Well, I think it kind of comes and goes, but we're hoping in 1999 to go back to full costume.
Oh, that'd be great. And what an appropriate year to do
that,
too.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Come back for that.
Oh, yeah. We won't be able to move, I think, everybody.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I'm inviting everybody anyway. So were there any particular fancy dresses that you did attend that stand out?
The Diamond Jubilee, there was a 75th. I have posters from all of them. They kind of blend together, which perhaps is more indicative of substance abuse, I guess, than anything else. None stands out to me anyway as being, you know, a quintessentially great thing. They all kind of blur for me. Kathy hated them. I took her to one. Didn't like it. Too loud. Too much beer on the floor. Can't move. And so the last one I went to was in 86.
You know they don't serve beer at Fancy Dress anymore?
No, I didn't know.
It's completely just sodas. It's all that's served at Fancy Dress.
That's probably better.
Well, it was very civilized last year.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I guess with the age, I mean, it just gets so hard to try to monitor your 21-year-old.
So were you there in the time when the drinking age was 18?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can buy beer when you're 18. That's why I'm as large as I am now. I got to WNL and I weighed about 180 pounds. Those days are gone.
I have a friend who just graduated from WNL, and when he left, he was a little on the heavy side. Well, I went and saw him when I was in Atlanta a couple months ago. He's like a whole different person.
Back to normal.
Yes. but not to me. To me, his roundness was normal, and I was like, Richard, what happened to you?
Well, you know, you can buy a six-pack of Budweiser and drink that, and then a case of Natty Bo for about the same that you paid for the six-pack of Bud. And once you've had a six-pack of Bud, National Bohemian doesn't taste all that bad. So you could buy a lot of beer economically, and once you were 18, you could do it. In high school, we used to, Covington's about 17 miles away from White Sulphur Springs in West Virginia, and you could buy liquor in West Virginia at age 18, and it would give new meaning to the word go west, young man, because you'd have your 18-year-old seniors who'd drive to West Virginia and make your purchases for you. It has nothing to do with Washington and Lee, but it's the background that I came from.
So you use the term, it's your term, not mine, substance abuse.
Yeah.
Looking back from your wizened old age now, what do you think about the amount of alcohol that's consumed by these undergraduates?
Well, I can't point at anybody and damn them because I'm the biggest sinner myself, but I drank a lot of beer, a lot of alcohol. I don't know that it was institutional. Yeah, we got into huge trouble. It was my, I think it was my freshman year. I think it was my freshman year, and the Glee Club went to Charleston, West Virginia, and they had just to perform for the alumni, and they had just built a new, you know, recital hall or something that we were singing in, and the Yale Whiffin' Poofs, which were like the be-all and all kind of male college ensemble, had just been there a few weeks before and had been absolutely top drawer and fabulous. And we went and we went, and for some reason, don't know why, for some reason, they threw the cocktail party. It's funny I say the cocktail party, like it was the obligatory cocktail party. They threw a cocktail party for us before the concert. And Spice, I think, kind of saw the writing on the wall, and he said, okay, a two-drink limit. Nobody drinking more than two drinks, because we got to perform. And I don't know that anybody drank just two drinks, and there were a number of fairly inebriated singers when the sound was not that good. The regular pianist could not play one of the pieces that we were supposed to play. I had to play it. He couldn't do it. And Spice was furious. Just, that's one of the, we were talking about, it's really funny, we were talking about that after Todd's service, and we were talking about Spice, and the one time that virtually everybody could remember, you know, him as being visibly angry was that time. But yeah, there was a lot of drinking going on. There was a lot of things going on when I was there.
A lot of things.
A lot of pot, cocaine. Cocaine got really big. I mean, that was, I think cocaine got big in the middle 80s nationally, and it was coming on strong. But I mean, you're there surrounded by a number of upper middle class, you know, or upper class, you know, young white males with a lot of disposable income. I mean, that was a breeding ground for that kind of stuff anyway, I think. I was aware of it going on. And never, I've smoked the occasional joint, I suppose. I never got ambitious and did anything else other than that, but it was certainly there and available if you wanted to. I hate to think, and I don't really think, that the university actively fostered that kind of environment, but I think that kind of environment just sort of naturally grew up there at the university. I mean, I don't think that either administration or the faculty or anybody was particularly permissive or lax or, you know, didn't exhibit the proper kind of vigilance or concern, but just some things that are going to develop in those kinds of settings, and that sure did.
Well, it also reflected what was going on in the rest of the world, too.
Yeah, I don't think you could expect WNL to be this little island, this Brigadoon, you know, in the...
No, that's funny. A couple of people have described it as Brigadoon.
In some ways it is. I mean, some... I think the honor system kind of makes it a Brigadoon of sorts, because you can really stop worrying a lot about those kinds of issues, about cheating, about stealing, about dishonesty. And it still happens, but not to the degree that it does in the real world. So in that sense, it kind of is. But in terms of some of the sins of the flesh, I guess, that society as a whole is susceptible to, you know, it's no different than any other place, like you said.
Now, what are the other uniquely Washington and Lee events, or practically uniquely, is mock convention?
Yeah. Missed it.
Missed it?
Missed it. Mock convention was in 1984.
Yeah.
And I was in Germany.
Oh. Well, you missed it. Like, yeah. It occurs to me that it had to have been one of the more boring mock convention. It was all a foregone conclusion, I would think.
Pretty much.
In 1984.
Yeah, it was.
Who would the sacrificial lamb was going to be?
Oh, well. These things happen.
So you were in Germany.
Yeah, I did the spring semester abroad.
Of your senior year?
Yeah, kind of silly.
That's extraordinary.
Well, I don't know if it was extraordinary. I really wanted to do it. Glee Club went on tour in Germany in 1982, in the winter of 82. And I had it was a profound experience for me. I had the best time. Really kind of became a Germanophile of sorts at that point. And my friendship with Stevenson, too, had really, after I met him at the Whitehead party, we got to be really good friends. In fact, my mother kind of laughs that she got kind of jealous of Stevenson, because I used to go home like once a month or so, and I stopped doing that. I just spent free time that I had with him. And but anyway, all of that sort of caused me to take German. I started taking German junior year. And was good, modestly speaking, but I really, you know, you're good at the things you love, I guess. And so I really wanted to do the spring term in Germany, and the only opportunity really to do that was my senior year, and I decided I wanted to do that more than just hang around and do the normal seniorly kinds of things. So I went, got back a couple days before baccalaureate.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. 20 pounds heavier.
I'll bet.
No lie.
I believe it. I've
been
there.
Pictures to prove it.
I've been there. I know. Yeah. I know. It ain't Natty Bo over there.
No. And I lived with a butcher, darn it. That was great. I got up at 5:30 with his sons and went over in the shop and worked for the mornings, and had you'd work from about 5:30 to 7:30, and then you'd have coffee and cold cuts, or coffee and, you know, hard rolls or something, and then around noon you'd have the midday, you know, they'd cook a fairly big meal, you'd have a couple beers. So. And so begins my day, and then I was off to the university for classes in the afternoon, and then...
After two beers.
Yeah, and then frolicking in the evenings with my new German friends.
Well, Nick, you know what?
What?
We've been talking for at least an hour, and we haven't mentioned the classroom at all.
Yeah, go
figure.
Don't
you think we ought to?
Yeah, let's pay lip service at least to what we were there for. What do you want to know?
Well, I want to know. You've already mentioned Stevenson a lot.
Yeah.
A real important person.
Yeah, that
how,
really.
How was he in the classroom?
He was great. My favorite Stevenson classroom story. He was explaining German, different prepositions will take different cases, accusative, dative, instrumental, that kind of stuff. And he was explaining the German preposition an, A-N, and it means like if you would say that the picture hangs on the wall, you would use that preposition. It doesn't mean on in terms of the cup is sitting on the table, but you would use on as in, and his line was, he had this nervous tic that he would, when he was nervous, at the ends of his sentences or words would be in kind of an like that. It happened, I don't know why. But anyway, he was explaining on, he said, like a picture hangs up against, as in up against the wall, redneck mama. I laughed so hard I cried. He was a great teacher. He was just a great teacher. He taught me so much about, you know, he taught in the he taught Romance languages when he was there. He taught Russian. He started the Concert Guild. He taught German. He taught art history. He was incredible. What he knew. He was married briefly in the 70s to a Swiss actress, and he married late. He was already, in the 70s, he was in his 40s, and the marriage lasted for only a few years. And then she moved back to Basel, Switzerland. But class, you're right, classes, probably we should talk about them some. I started out not really sure what I wanted to major in. I thought I should be practical. And so I was like taking classes in the C school, which I just loathed. And finally, I don't know how it happened, but I started English was what I loved, and just decided, you know, well, this is what I love. And so what if it's not practical? I love it. That's what I'm going to do. So I switched my major from politics to how practical can you be, to English, and things took a decidedly happier turn at that point. Survived calculus. Professor Vinson struggled valiantly to get me through calculus, and he did. Did you ever hear the story about him? It was before my time. I don't know.
I don't even know the name.
Tom Vinson, V-I-N-S-O-N.
Uh-uh.
I don't. He's still there. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but he used to. Classes were in Robinson Hall, and his classroom was on the first floor. And after class, to avoid the crush in the hallways, he usually had a tennis match in the afternoon. So he'd go over and just hop out the window and run on to his tennis match. Well, one year they moved his class to the second floor. I don't know if it's true or not. I've heard that story. You probably ought to ask him. But I heard that he did it. So I don't know. That would have been 70s, I guess, late 70s sometime when that happened. So
I don't know if it's true or
not. He's wacky. The first 5 minutes of every class with Vincent, he would discuss that day's Gil Thorpe comic strip. It was a big thing. They'd talk about what was going on in Gil's life and what the future looked like, and then they'd start doing differential equations. And for the first 5 minutes, I was fine. But then, you know, once it really turned to the subject of calculus, I started sucking. But I spent most of my time in Payne, like Payne Hall, where the English department was. With Cowling, who's just an incredible professor.
Talk to me about him.
Oh boy, you come kind of close to idolatry with him. He's just sort of the consummate WNL, just a complete gentleman. Never seen him angry or raise his voice, and he can get up and talk about Matthew Arnold until the cows come home, and you just kind of listen and, you know, rapt attention. As I took, he taught a course on the Romantic poets, which I took, and the Victorian poetry course, which was just wonderful. But you can kind of talk. All of the English professors I had, I thought, were just fabulous, and I think English has been, at least, I don't know what it's like now, but was one of the real strong, I think, powerhouses when I was there in terms of the faculty. Severin Duval with American literature. Bob Huntley, he taught the British novel. There were three courses that he taught, sort of the survey of the British novel from Moll Flanders to, what was the most recent? Graham Greene, I guess, was the most recent author. And I took all of his, I took all three British novel survey courses, just great stuff. You know, I'd be sitting back at the apartment just kind of, you know, and I can proudly say that I never, that I read every assignment that was made, and I can proudly say that I never used Cliff Notes or anything like that. And that thanks to taking typing in high school, I typed all my own papers and didn't have to pay anybody to do that. But once I finally stumbled into the English department, it was a great 2.5 years, I guess. Took 2 years of Russian, and can't do much Russian anymore. My German's still good, but my Russian, I can say "Novая скатерть радость молодой жене," which means, it's one of those important grammatical sentences, it means the new tablecloth is a joy to the young housewife.
My transcriber is going to really appreciate that you said that.
I'll write it out for you. Took a few music courses, romantic music class, took Spice's opera seminar, which was fun. Took voice lessons from Spice. I had a semester of piano lessons from Jay Cook. Took microeconomics from John Winfrey, a dear man, but my economics just sort of, I don't get it. It always hit me as like small little men trying to put definitions on huge concepts that really can't be defined. Need something to drink? Need a glass of water or something? Or mo tea?
No, not more tea. I think I'm okay.
Scotch?
But if bourbon? No, vodka? I did not go to Washington.
I'm a WNL man. Get your beer?
No,
glass of
no,
wine.
No, I didn't go to WNL.
Some heroin?
No, thank you. You're very gracious.
Thank you. I'm trying to, please.
So how did an English major make the transition over to the law school? And how did you make that decision to do that?
Didn't want to leave Lexington.
Oh, I love that answer. Keep going.
Well, I mean,
that's the right answer, Nick.
Well, it's pretty much true. The options were teach somewhere at a private school, teach English at a private school somewhere, which just wasn't what I wanted to do, go on and get an advanced degree in English and perhaps teach at another level. Not what I wanted to do, I didn't think, and paying for it, more importantly, would have been a problem. Law school, there was some scholarship help. My family was not a family of means. In fact, next December I finish paying off my guaranteed student loan, so I will have paid for my education next year.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. Law school interested me. A law degree opened up some, you know, career avenues that otherwise would not have been open to me. And I got to stay. I know that sounds dumb, but I got dug in pretty deep in 4 years and loved Lexington. In fact, when I graduated from law school, and even since then, I've thought real seriously a couple times about trying to move back because it's just I just love it. It's just such a great place. So WNL Law School was the only law school that I applied to, and I got in, so I went.
Why is Lexington such a great place?
I've visited lots of big cities. I mean, New York, San Francisco, London, Munich. Been there, seen them, love them for the short stretch, but would not want to live there, don't want to live on a farm because I'd get bored too quickly. So by definition, I've sort of restricted myself to a smaller town or a small city. Lexington combined all the things that I found and still, for the most part, find to be desirable in a place to live. It's small and fairly intimate, but the people there, by and large, are intelligent, well-educated, artistic, fun. I don't know, it just combines all of those, you know, the size is good, the kind of people who are there are interesting. What goes on both campuses, both at BMI and at WNL, in terms of lectures, concerts, exhibits, speakers, is all very interesting and challenging.
Talk to me about that. Were there any particular people who impressed you in the time you were in Lexington?
Impressed.
There are some fairly impressive people who come through that place.
Yeah. Let's see. Some of the noteworthy ones. G. Gordon Liddy. He was impressive for all of the wrong reasons. Yeah, he spoke in the chapel. He scared the pee out of me. he got ticked off while he was speaking, though, because Pete Whitehead, who was in my class, had brought a rubber Nixon mask and put it on at one point during Liddy's talk, and Liddy saw him and said he knew 100 ways to kill a person with a pencil and don't push him. It's like, okay. All kinds of, well, shoot. You remember Jeff McNelly, the political cartoonist, and he also drew Shu, that comic strip. He was different. He came. He was showing some drawings, and they threw the floor open for questions. And somebody asked him why he put, you know, shoes on his birds. I mean, what took you there? You know, why did you do that? And he said, well, I thought it would be different and interesting, and I can't draw birds' feet. It's like, okay, thank you very much. And the Concert Guild brought through, you know, really good ensembles. The Audubon strings would come through. Leon Bates, a really good pianist, who's made more and more of a name for himself as time has gone on. The first time I heard him was there in Lee Chapel. I don't know, there's just, you're right, there is sort of an impressive array of people coming through to speak. Roger Mudd was there, an alum. I don't know, there's just lots to do in Lexington. I don't, you know, a lot of people would complain, friends of mine would complain about, yikes, you know, small town, nothing to do. And I was like, come on with me to Covington, I'll show you nothing to do. We can go watch the paper mill.
All right, let's go back to the law school. Were there any teachers who made a big difference for you there?
Yeah, there were great professors there. Uncas McThenia, really, really good professor, good man too. I've gotten to know him since then. Some, we were both Episcopalians. We disagree fairly fundamentally about some of the stuff that went on during the Pittston strike when he was so involved in the mine workers' strike. It was Groot, Roger Groot, scare you to death. He used the Socratic method, and he would call on you, and he would stick with you until you died. We had classmates who got nauseous and had to leave the room. He'd always call on the Vanderbilt person first, though, so you pretty much knew, you know, that first day anyway, that if there was anybody in your section from Vanderbilt, he or she was going to be the one who got reamed out first.
Did they know it?
Word sort of got around, so they would be prepared for whatever the material was for the first class. And he called on me, finally. We had gotten to, I'd had him for crim law. And I will go to my grave knowing that larceny is the caption and aspartation of the personal property of another with the intent to permanently deprive him or her of ownership. It's sort of etched into my brain. It's like, Mr. Leach, let's say you're over here at the Harris Teeter, and let's say you put a pizza in your cart. Is that a caption? Yes, sir. Is that aspartation? Yes, sir. Is that larceny? Well, no, sir, I'm going to pay for it, so I don't have the intent. That's right, that's good. And he was scary. It was all kind of a, you know, there was a veneer of frightening, you know, a scary veneer to Groot, and then once you kind of got past that, he's kind of a sweetheart. Lives over in Buena Vista. Go figure. He said, if you can't get it in Buena, you don't need it. I was like, okay. Take your word for it. And Henneman, I just love Henneman. He taught all the trusts and estates classes, which I really dug in law school. And since then, I have written maybe a half a dozen wills. I mean, it's just not my practice. I litigate. I'm in the courtroom. But in law school, I really liked that subject matter. And he used to say, they weren't really one-liners, but usually every lecture, one thing he said, I thought was just memorable and noteworthy. So I carried a notebook with me, and I would record his little Hennemanisms. In fact, I posted them on the bulletin board one year at the end of the semester. And one of them was... that I still remember, joint tenancies are wonderful things. They give the surviving spouse a place to sleep after the funeral. And I swear, my father died in 87, like 10 days before I graduated from law school. And one of the things I remember thinking at the gravesite was, I got tickled a little bit. It was, you know, well... joint tenancies are wonderful things. We've got a place to go. But he was a really good professor and has turned into a good friend. That was one of the good things I thought about W&L in general on both sides of the ravine. And I hope it never changes. The student-faculty ratio was such that you really were a name. I mean, my professors knew me. They knew who I was. They knew what I did. And it wasn't just because, you know, I was something special or important. I mean, they knew who their students were. They knew what their parents did. They knew what their backgrounds were. They knew what their interests were. And they were there, you know, and you didn't even have to take a class from them. I mean, I got to know Dr. Margand. She's in the psych department. Never took a psychology course, never, ever. But I just knew who she was. In fact, I saw her when I was up for Todd's service, just kind of bumped into her, you know, big hug and hi, and how you doing, Dr. Nan? Nice to see you. And just, it was a really good environment for developing meaningful relationships, I think, with faculty. And, you know, Stevenson obviously was the big one for me, and Spice, Kirk Folo was a friend, Henneman and Uncas McThenia on the law side are good friends, Joan Shaughnessy, just, you know, all of the people I've rattled off were at my wedding. You know, they came. I got married in Covington, and They came. It was really weird, but really, it was a wonderful place. It was a great place to learn. It really was. Warts and all, you know, all of the problems that I sort of associated with the unigender kind of education and the bad things that could kind of flow from that, that even couldn't, you know, couldn't really blot out what a great place it was to put new things in your head. It really was great. I could, if money were no object, I could just go back and probably stay forever.
Well, that's a wonderful way to end this. This thing is beeping at
me.
Oh,
okay.
Well, I could pop in another tape if you have other things you want to talk about.
Yeah, better not, actually. Well, thank you.
That was a wonderful ending line, though.
Well,
thank you, Nick.
Well,
and thank you, Rob, for sending me here.
I was laying awake trying to think of anecdotes the past few, you know, days of, because I really didn't, I kind of worried about this, to be honest. I wasn't sure what I had to say, you know, that was noteworthy.
You've done just fine.
Well,